Hello, and welcome back to the Brew Theology Podcast and our discussion with Dr. Brian Gammel. As we continue our discussion today, we'll talk about Rudolf Bultmann and existentialism, among other topics. So thanks for joining. If you want to know more about Brew Theology, you can find us at brewtheology.org. You can find us at Brew Theology on Instagram and Facebook, and at brew_theology on X. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. So how is his existentialism fitting in here?
I'd be happy to talk about that. So yes, Bultmann reads, he would argue that a proper reading of the New Testament would be an existentialist reading, that what it's really concerned with is talking about the way in which we experience God now, that we respond to God now, and so that at every moment we are open to hearing God speak to us through the Bible, through preachers, through the world around us, that we are open to hearing God, and that we need in all those moments to be ready to respond. He draws from the work of Martin Heidegger, which was his friend, a famous existentialist philosopher. And so there has been a lot of work done to talk about the direction of that influence. Did Bultmann simply just take Heidegger and apply it to the New Testament, or was Heidegger also influenced by Bultmann? I won't speak to all that. I'm not actually a Bultmann scholar. That's not my primary interest. But that is certainly the lens through which he tends to see the world. Now, I would say that on that idea about did this really happen, that I think that Bultmann would query the really part of that statement. So if something is not historical, or if we can't nail down a historical aspect to it, is that an event or a happening? And this is where Bultmann would push back to say, well, not everything that is significant, not everything that is Geschichte has some kind of historical, you know, or we can't identify this thing. And so did it happen in the sense that we can identify this kind of miracle? Well, Bultmann would probably say no. But did it happen in the sense that God acted in history to change the views, change the way in which these early believers understood and saw crucifixion? Then yes, it is real. It's a real thing that happened. And we can talk about the phenomenology of that. But the actual encounter, the actual God acting is never visible. We can never see it. We can never see God's action as a singularity, so to speak, on its own, you know, apart from a black hole, or to use a metaphor. We can never see God's action in the world by itself. It's always in, with, and under what we might call a secular event. And so that event looks normal. It looks like a regular event to everybody else. And what that means then is that there's no ultimate trump card that a theist or a believer can use or say to say, look, that is clearly, without question, undeniably an act of God because it is miraculous in nature. It is always something that is paradoxical. It is something that both looks like a normal event, a normal secular event, and also, nevertheless, he would say, is an act of God. And it is that nevertheless that is important for Bultmann, that we can both say it is this secular event and nevertheless, God is acting in this moment. And God's action in the world is always an action on me. It is not simply for the sake of theatrics. God doesn't just do something spectacular for the sake of being spectacular.
Yeah.
God's not showing off. God is acting always on me in every moment.
Okay, so what would be a better word to describe God, assuming we could just time warp Bultmann today and say, hey, man, like, if you don't like the word God in a sense, God is not an object. God is not the other. God works within. A lot of people would just say, a lot of my agnostic atheist friends, and I'm sure yours too, would just say, well, why use the word God? How would he describe God just to the average person?
See, he's famous for saying that God is not a what, but a how. And part of what he means by that is that when we put God in the category of what, we're thinking of object. We're thinking of some kind of thing somewhere. And maybe it's a supernatural thing. Maybe it's a genie. Maybe it's this kind of fairy. And so I know a lot of the language now, like a very common atheist kind of snipe at theists would be talking about the sky fairy that saves them or sprinkles dust in their lives. And that's precisely the kind of thing Bultmann wants to avoid. Is this idea that God is somehow even a magical, invisible thing somewhere out there. That is not what God is. What Bultmann would say is God is that which determines our identity. God is that which determines our behavior. And so for Bultmann, one way of understanding that is God is what God does. God is identified, in a sense, with the kerygma. God is identified with this voice. God is identified with this encounter that we have. Now, trying to imagine, so God is the encounter. God is the voice. God is the thing, or the, even using thing as problematic. God is that which determines my action, my proper conduct in the world. And as soon as I want to identify that and marry that to this object or thing, that, for Bultmann, is where we go astray. So does that mean that God has no metaphysical existence apart from the kerygma? Well, no, I don't think, for Bultmann. It's just that we can't say anything meaningful or intelligible about that. And so the idea that we kind of want to talk about God in God's self is an attempt to really turn the tables around and say, okay, let's probe God. Let's study God as though God were a frog, or as though God were some object that we could investigate and study and apply a set of tools to. But God only ever interacts with us by summoning us, by calling us, by addressing us, by both judging us and forgiving us. That is the way that God interacts with us. And so God is largely mystery, and we know God through kerygma. We know God supremely through the person of Jesus Christ, and then through the message or summons that emanates from him. And so the attempts to talk about God in those terms are all going to fail. So now, for many people, that can feel like a cop-out, that can feel like a way of saying, oh, well, see, you're avoiding this whole metaphysical discussion. And perhaps that is the case. And Bultmann, I think, would say, like, well, there is no ultimate trump card that, again, Christians or other theists can use against unbelievers or atheists to say, aha, this is it. This is the thing you can't explain. And we have this kind of undeniable proof. There is no proof. There is an existential reality that you can only testify to when you've had that encounter yourself.
Is it safe to say that in the Eastern Orthodox tradition that they would find this more appealing than in Western constructs and paradigms?
That's interesting. I don't know enough about the day-in, day-out spirituality of most Eastern Orthodox, and I'm also not steeped in Eastern Orthodox theology. I think that the things that would appeal to them, perhaps that might be what I can say, is that they, I think, would appreciate the element of mystery. I think they would appreciate the move away from a Western kind of scholasticism. I think those things would be appealing, perhaps. I don't want to speak for them, to them about Bultmann. They might be also unnerved about his demythologizing. I don't know that they would want to really embrace that. That's that move that Bultmann does to get back to what he would say is this kind of existential core, I think that they would find probably a little disturbing. But so I don't want to speak for them, but those are perhaps the things they would find attractive or unattractive about him.
I don't know if I can ask this question intelligently. What I'm hearing a tension between, I'm hearing one interpretation of God that reminds me of like panentheism, that God is in all and surrounds all and moves all, and that maybe he would be okay with that when you're talking about his acts are inside of normal events. They're not super visible. They're not miracles. They're part of the way that we move through the world every day. But then I also hear this, what to me feels very evangelical thing about, you hear this through the preaching, you hear this through the calling, through God's judgment, through forgiveness. Am I hearing that kind of tension there? Is that accurate? Or is there more you could say to, I don't know, parse those things out?
Sure. I think that both of those kinds of elements do seem very apparent in Bultmann, that God seems to be intimately involved in all aspects of the world, or at least I can encounter God in all aspects of the world. And yet also, what it is that I encounter does feel very evangelical. And I think this is the thing that surprised me as a former evangelical when I read and studied Bultmann deeply, and that continues to surprise people, is the degree to which he sounds like a conventional evangelical. I would say that the aspects of both of those things that he would problematize is that with a panentheism, that panentheism wants to identify God at least intimately with the world, that God is in all parts of the world. And Bolman would say, God is wholly other. God is not part of the world. Even though I can find God in my experience in the world, God is not to be identified with the world. So in that sense, he would be kind of, we might say, classically evangelical, or just really classically theist. And then what he would, I think, the way he would probably become problematic for the evangelical is by saying that, well, his whole program of demythologizing, I think,
right,
that's highly suspect in most of their eyes. And also with his insistence that God's action is not identified with these certain special events in the world.
Right.
So there's actually a different term that is used, I think, in more modern theology that some thinkers, some scholars have talked about that I would apply to Bolman, and that is this idea of actualistic ontology.
Okay.
It's a big word that means that God's being, if you want to understand what God is like, that God is what God does, which I referred to earlier. So actualistic meaning that it's God's action that determines God's being, and ontology, of course, is the big word that means being. So what that means then is that God is to be identified with God's action. This actually goes back to a reformed idea. I think Luther talks about that Christ is identified with Christ's benefits. We know Christ through Christ's benefits and is identified with them. And this is kind of taking that idea a bit further to say that God, whatever God is in God's self metaphysically, for Bolman would be completely unknown. How would we ever know that? How would we ever find any way to plumb those kinds of depths? We have no idea. So we would just be like blind people walking around trying to talk about color. We have no idea. How would we have any idea what that means? So the only way we know anything about God is because God acts on us. God addresses us. God summons us. And so insofar as we can know anything, God is identified with that summons. God is identified with that action. God is the message of the kerygma in the world. Is that all that God is? Well, no. But to say any more than that for Bolton would be a sin. So we're now talking about something we have no idea what we're talking about. But the part of us that we can engage with is that kind of actualistic part. And this actually goes back again to a very Lutheran idea. Luther criticizes a lot of medieval theology by saying that their idea of theology is that there's a foci, a dot, and that's God, and all of theology is just thoughts about God in abstraction. And what Luther would say is that there's two foci, there's God and people, and this interaction between God and people, that's what theology studies, that's what theology is interested in, and all of the Bible is interested in that interaction. It's not interested in just talking about God and God's self. Like, there's no way we could ever have that kind of, that idea about theology as though theology is like chemistry or like physics or biology. Like, there's a realm of study and we're just going to study the lemur in itself or the electron in itself. That is not an appropriate analogy to talk about theology. It's always about this dynamic between humans and God. And to the degree that is true, then talking about God is essentially talking about what God does in, with, and for us.
So what would his level of priorities be with like accountability and community and in tradition and in the higher ups, if you will? Because it sounds that God is acting on us and we have this subjective experience. It could lend itself to some potential illusions, psychiatric evaluations, if you will. Like, oh, I had this experience with God. Here's what it looks like. So that must be God. How closely tied is he to some kind of accountability? So otherwise God could just be whatever I experience.
Right. Well, so again, I will say, as I'm venturing on what Bolman might think or say, I have to emphasize again that Bolman is not actually my area of study directly. I'm a New Testament scholar and I find Bolman highly fascinating and useful. So I'll say the rest of this tentatively, happy to be corrected by people who know Bolman much better. I will say, first of all, that Bolman is often accused of having a highly individualistic kind of version of Christianity or of religion, that it becomes about my existential experience really apart from anything else. And that perhaps is a fair critique. Having said that, I think that a lot of what goes unargued by Bolman is simply assumed. And that is that the way that we encounter God is through the reading of Christian scriptures. It is through the church. It is through the ministers or the priests that are part of it. For example, he has this essay about how God speaks through the Bible. And it's a very short essay, just a few pages. And when you get into it, you think, oh, he's going to explain, like, this is the mechanism. This is the way that God actually speaks to the Bible. And he starts by saying, well, who's asking this question? The person who asked the question, how God speaks to the Bible, must assume that God does speak to the Bible. But then the real question is not how God speaks to the Bible. The question is, am I ready to hear God speak? Or am I simply interested in deconstructing this notion? Am I simply interested in kind of trapping God and talking about God in abstraction? Or am I ready to hear God speak to me? Am I ready to be a recipient of a message that would curtail me, that would expose me, that would scandalize me and open me up to new life, but in the process might be quite scary and uncomfortable to me? So at the end of the essay, he doesn't answer the question, how does God speak through the Bible? He simply affirms that God doesn't speak, indeed speak through the Bible, because, and he says that it's because we in the church, and he's speaking as a Christian, we assume that someone has said, here is this text, God speaks through this text, and that we come to encounter that. So in the same way, his answer to most of those things would be, well, yes, certainly you could claim anything that you want about your encounter with God, but it is normed by the Christian tradition. It is normed by participation in a church. And so I don't think that Bultmann could imagine, for example, a kind of Christianity that's entirely divorced from the church, from the Bible, from a set of ordained ministry. Those things seem like assumptions for him. And I don't know where he would spell those things out, but he's writing in time when you still have a national church. And that was a common experience in Europe. And those things seem like somewhat of assumptions for him. So having said that, sure, there's ways of appropriating these ideas from Bultmann, I suppose, divorced from those settings and abstracted from that, that could lead to whatever you want them to be. But at that point, it no longer becomes a kind of Christianity. It would just become a kind of, I suppose, individual metaphysical or existential experience. But it wouldn't be what Bultmann's talking about, because he wants to recover this kerygma, this idea of God speaking through Jesus to people.
What might he say to people that are deconstructing and leaving the church now? That's very different from the world he lived in, but is there wisdom found in his work that might inform that journey?
Yeah, I think so. I think that when people hear the language of demythologizing, which, by the way, Bultmann wasn't happy with, he didn't like that phrase. He just didn't think that there was a better term, because the term is negative. I think that when people hear the term demythologizing, they often assume that it is simply a synonym for deconstruction.
Right.
That what they mean by deconstruction is what he means by demythologizing. And often in the kind of modern context we're in now, at least the ways I'm familiar with, deconstruction often is a way of saying, well, there are all these things I assumed about my spirituality or about my faith that are no longer true, and I'm rejecting them, and I'm trying to find if there's anything at all that I can kind of salvage from that. And maybe nothing. Maybe it's all to just be deconstructed and left aside, and I become kind of ex-evangelical. What Bultmann would say is that his project is not about deconstruction in itself. It's not about tearing it apart, but it is actually about recovering the message of the kerygma. It is about being able to hear the message of the early Christians in a way that makes sense to us. So this is his problem with mythology, is that even though mythology helps us to talk about what is existentially, it can also lead to a kind of objectifying, to where then I look at these stories and I think, oh, look at the Bible, look at how it talks about God, look at how naive it seems to sound, as though that's really what the Bible is interested in, is talking about these, what seems like to many people, fairy tales. What Bultmann wants to say is, that is all just the medium, the kind of stories, the kind of language, the kind of imagery that is being used there are all the ways that these authors had at their disposal. They didn't have 21st century scientific worldviews, and so they're not going to talk that way. They're not going to speak about those kinds of things. And so when they're using language about light and dark or above and below, or you can even talk about the language of demon possession, you can go on and on. The point there is that all of those have meaning. And demythologizing, for example, does not mean just getting rid of all of those ideas behind it. It means understanding. So he would always say that demythologizing is not eliminating myth. It is interpreting it. It is talking about what it's trying to say. So what, for example, is the point of the story of the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness by the devil? Well, a deconstruction might say, oh, that's not true. Like, we know that this is highly stylized. It has these three elements to it. We see other examples of this in other kinds of religious literature. We don't have other examples of this. This seems like an invention of the early Christians, and we don't believe in demons. And so none of this is important. None of this matters at all. We can just basically safely ignore this. That would be a kind of deconstructive move on that passage. A demythologizing move might be to say, well, what is it about the experience of evil that encounter or this episode wants to talk about? What is it about the nature of temptation? What is it about the way in which Jesus as human par excellence that the gospel writers are trying to convey? And they're doing that in the only language they have, which is the language of their culture. How would we understand that, not simply as a story about something that just happened to Jesus and I can observe it from a safe distance, but also as a message to me, as a message that is directed to me? How could I hear that story, the message or the story about Jesus being tempted in the wilderness, as a story about myself or as a story that has meaning for me right now? And that's what Boltman would want, I think, to say about that passage and all others, is that all of those are written, like Paul says, for our benefit. They are addressed to us. They have existential freight, but we can dismiss it if we just simply think, oh, that's a fairy tale, or that's a nice story that doesn't have any real meat to it. But for Boltman, demythologizing is not simply deconstruction. It is the ability to hear the intent of these stories in the way that they would have been first heard. And so I guess that what I would say to someone who is thinking those things through is that Boltman can be a great ally, because what he's interested in is not simply saying, well, you have to believe all the assumptions of this ancient culture, and you just have to adopt it for your own uncritically. But it is also not just the wholesale rejection of all of that entirely. It is an attempt to hear the message, the kerygma, the preaching of the early Christians in a way that I can hear and that makes sense to me as well.
This has been fantastic, Brian. I appreciate you, your work. I know you said you're not an expert on Boltman, but you are, compared to Janelle and myself and our listeners. So we, man, respect that. And I hope if you're listening out there and you like this, again, share it. We're at Brew Theology on Facebook and Instagram and on X, formerly known as Twitter, that's Brew_Theology. So thanks again, Brian. Cheers to you. Cheers to this divine dance that we're all trying to live.
Absolutely. So great to be here. And I will say, just to all your listeners, if they are interested in reading more about this or studying more about this, a great author that I have met and know is named David Congdon. And he has written extensively about Boltman in all kinds of capacities. And they can find books that he has written by him that are easily accessible and that would extend this conversation. I would highly recommend them.
Cool. Thank you.
Absolutely. Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
Cheers.
Have a good one.